Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm good. Wow, we've hardly had any conversations this week. How are you?
You know, I'm a little disappointed in this fall, you know.
Why? Because you can't ride?
Well, when I interviewed Fall back at the toward the end of summer, he promised that he was going to be a very different season than what we had had in June, July, and August.
And it is.
And he's delivered on that promise, but not in a good way.
I'm very disappointed. It's been very cold and rainy here in Ohio.
Yes, it has.
I think our water deficit has been made up and then some.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's been a busy week in the news for the racing community, yes?
Yeah, if only I gave a rat's ass about professional cycling, I would be, you know, kind of...
You'd have lots to see and do and read and talk about. Well,
been following it a little bit.
We're not going to talk about a lot of it, but a little bit. Paul Kimmage, as we know, has been served with a lawsuit by the UCI. And he decided this week that all the publicity was starting to wear thin on his personal life. And while he admitted he was kind of enjoying the ride and all that was going on with it, he decided to duck off of Twitter. So he's no longer on Twitter, and he's preparing for his upcoming day in court. Mm-hmm. Last time I looked at the defense fund, which I still look at each week on cyclismus.com, it was $56,000. So hopefully it will be enough for him to defend himself. I still think the UCI would be smart in saying, maybe we don't need to go through with it.
In for a penny, in for a pound.
That's true.
Once you start down that road,
that's true.
There really isn't any way to back out of it or to just say, oh, just kidding, never mind, you know?
Well, pretty much everybody's talked about the USADA report, the reasoned
decision. Yeah.
Which anybody can see just by typing in Lance Armstrong into the Google search engine. You know, I want to change the subject, but I want to just say there have been some really good articles about it. There have been some really bad articles about it. There have been so much conversation about it. It's just unbelievable. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of things that happened this week that if you want to catch up on it, just go read this investigation statement from the USADA.org. It's Cycling Investigation Statement. It's quite long. It's 200 pages. I know you skimmed it, you said.
I skimmed through it just to say what was there directly, because you can read a lot of articles and, you know, get someone's slant on it.
Sure, but, sure.
I think the biggest thing that happened this week was not necessarily the reasoned decision release, but the statement by both George Hincapie and Levi Leipheimer that they had doped all through those years.
Right. Right. You know, and they took 6 month suspensions.
You know, and so, you know, no one said that about them. No. They said that about themselves.
Right.
And it makes it kind of hard to have plausible deniability for Mr. Armstrong when those guys were coming out and admitting that they participated. So
one of the best articles I saw was and I think I told you about it. It was brought up on one of the Facebook sites, and it was sort of a, you know, all he has to do is just say, look, it's time. I'm coming clean.
Speaking of that article.
Yeah.
I was reading it, and there's a great quote in there.
Okay.
Just as two lines.
Go.
People can forgive human failure, and they're essentially predisposed to forgive a superhuman cancer crusader. What nobody likes is to have his or her intelligence insulted.
That's right. Exactly.
I think that really distills
great.
Down.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? We'll post a link to that article. That article, I just thought it sort of distilled the whole thing down into a really understandable, simple, you know, because I need the cliff notes for this reasoned decision. Somebody needs to do that for me. I don't have time to go through 200 pages of that.
It's a lot of repetition, to be honest
with you. I'm sure it is.
Once you've kind of seen the basic scenario of who's involved and what they're doing it and how they're doing it, then it's just, you know, talking about more and more instances
of the same thing. Sure.
And I will say, before we'll move on from this, I promise we're going to move on from this, but from the way that the USADA reasoned decision document lays it out, the UCI are a bunch of incompetent boobs.
Oh, this is news to you?
Or as Paul Kimmage claimed, they're complicit,
well,
or
that's,
perhaps both.
I think that's more likely. They are very complicit and acting really ridiculously stupid. They look stupid.
Let's go up to a hotel room full of cyclists in the Tour de France to do doping controls. And, you know, let's have our full, you know, name tags in view so that they all know we're coming.
Right.
You know, right up the...
Oh, I think it was... you know what? I brought you Secret Race.
I got the book.
I finished it this week.
Yeah.
And you should read it and you'll have a whole nother... I mean, it's just... Whew, wow.
Oh, okay.
All right, we're moving on.
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Hey, one bit of quick good local news that you and I just shared a minute ago.
Yes.
We got to pop the champagne on this
one. Here we go. Pop!
The Conservation Fund recently bought Acacia Country Club from its membership, and they turned around and donated it to the Cleveland Metro Parks.
That's correct. It's 155 acres, and it will go back to natural land as opposed to a golf course, which it's been for probably, I'll bet it's been a century.
So that puts one more little jewel in the emerald necklace here in Cleveland.
And it's inner city. It's right across the street from Beechwood Mall and right next to Legacy Village. And so it's going to be this little jewel of a park, like right in Lyndhurst, which is very cool.
Yeah, I love it. I'm excited too. Yeah. Okay, so
okay,
now we
so
move on to the
show. We have a show. Yes, we have three very diverse guests this week talking about three different areas of cycling, music and bikes, track racing, and the Philly Biker Expo, which is coming up at the end of the month. First up, we're going to go out to the West Coast and talk with Cello Joe. His real name is Joey Chang, and I don't usually associate hip-hop with the cello. But Cello Joe takes his instrument to some unusual places, musically and literally. He's billed as the International Bicycle Touring Vagabond Troubadour Cyclist. It's a good title. I like it. His group, the Ginger Ninjas, travel by bicycle with a film crew, and there was a 500-mile or 5,000-mile trip and a 100-hour documentary that was made. Joey's going to tell us about the film, his work, and he might even play us a tune or two, which I'm just fascinated by his work. Then we're going to talk right here in the studio with the president of the Board of Trustees of the Cleveland Velodrome, Brett Davis. Brett joined us last spring to talk about the then still being built velodrome, and we said we'd bring him back when it's completed. Well, it's up, it's running, it opened August 30th, and he's going to tell us what's transpired and what's coming up for the future of our velodrome here in Northeast Ohio. And then we're going to just take a few minutes and scoot on over to Philadelphia, where we'll talk with Expo producer Bina Belinke, who's going to tell us about the third annual Philly Bike Expo coming up at the end of October. So let's head on out to the San Francisco Bay Area and talk with Cello Joe. Joey, thanks for joining us on the Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited because I came across a project that you're involved in and wanted to know more. So would you tell me a little bit about yourself and especially your musical background?
Okay. Well, I am Joey Chang. I also go by Cello Joe. And I am the wildest beatboxing cello playing international bicycle touring cellist in the West. And my musical background is... I've played cello for 22 years, and I've studied privately. I was in a youth symphony for 6 years, and I also went to Berklee College of Music.
You also played piano as a youngster, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
I still play piano, not as well as I did.
So you started out as a classical cellist, and then from what I read, it sounded like you got kind of bored. And you moved to a more modern street-type music. So how did you transition from this youth orchestra, cellist, probably in a tuxedo, to what you're doing now, which is kind of classical hip-hop is what you call it, which is very cool, by the way.
Thanks. I made the transition while I was playing on the street. 7 or 8 years into playing the cello, I started going out downtown in the next town over from me, Palo Alto, California, and I started playing on the street down there. And originally I went out and just played, you know, all the classical stuff I knew, and I brought a music stand and all that. That got kind of boring after a while, because I've played through my whole repertoire in a couple hours. And so I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I could make up songs and sing like some of the other guys I saw down there that played guitar? And I was improvising, and then I taught myself how to sing and play the cello at the same time. And then I also was always beatboxing because all my friends listened to hip-hop, and we all listened to hip-hop. And so I heard Rozelle from The Roots, and I heard other beatboxers, and then I thought, well, I should learn how to do that too, because that's some music that I can practice all the time.
You added something called a loop pedal, which I imagine, and I know how it works because I've watched you do it on your website, and that's what really intrigued me was you play the cello, you use your voice, you use the loop pedal, and the stuff starts coming back, and it becomes sort of its own background and its own, it fills in all of the spaces for the music. It's really cool. I love the way it works. We're going to play some in a little bit. So people are probably wondering, all right, why is she talking to this dude about his hip-hop classical cello playing? And I think we're going to let him know why right now. Let's wrap your music into your bicycle journeys. So you are the world's first long-distance musical bike touring cellist, according to your bio.
Yes, according to myself.
Oh, okay.
I haven't actually verified the veracity of that. But I haven't heard of any other people before me that have done long-distance bicycle tours with a cello, except for there is one lady, but she started doing it after I did.
So you are the first.
Rule. Yeah, she's from Australia and Tasmania.
Got it.
So I'm also not the only beatboxing cello player in the world. There's actually a guy that's getting a lot of recognition from New York, because he's been on some TV shows and stuff. But what I do like to say is that I'm the world's only beatboxing cellist international bicycle touring vagabond troubadour.
Got it. And I think that that's a title to which you are very much entitled. As we move through this, people are going to see why. So you've done several pretty lengthy tours, including... I know one across the northern part of the country, one down into Mexico, and one in Europe. What's Pleasant Revolution?
Okay, this is actually words from the founder of the Pleasant Revolution that he said on stage in the Czech Republic. He said, "The Pleasant Revolution is a never-ending bicycle music tour around the world, and in fact, around the galaxy."
Wow. And who is part of the revolution besides the listeners? Obviously, he's probably being inclusive and saying everybody's part of the Pleasant Revolution. But who are the is it a group? Is it a group of musicians?
Yes, it is led by the Ginger Ninjas, which is a band that tours by bicycle, and they have a pedal-powered sound system, but it's become more of a collective. Like, the first tour that we ever did was in 2007. There was a documentary movie made about it called The Ginger Ninjas Ride Mexico. And it was just kind of done as a lark to see if it was possible for a band to travel with a pedal-powered sound system where the audience pedals the bikes in place and they're pedaling generators that make electricity for the sound system. And for a band to tour without any support vehicle and to carry everything on their bikes. So we used extra cycle cargo bikes, which is what I still have and still tour with. And we rode from North San Juan, California, which is near Sacramento, down to the bottom of Mexico to Palenque.
How many miles was that? How many?
About 5,000 miles.
Wow. And so how many of you were members of this group? How many people are in the Pleasant Revolution or were for that tour?
For that tour, the numbers fluctuated between 10 and 20, usually around 13 to 15. But sometimes we pick up extra people and sometimes they took off.
Wow.
Then we also did the tour in the Pacific Northwest from Portland to Vancouver, B.C., and we organized bicycle music festivals in the major cities along the way in Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver. And that was a 500-mile trip. It was about 2 weeks. The numbers were bigger on that. We had more than 20 people for the ride from Seattle to Vancouver. And then we did a tour in 2010 through Europe. That was a five-month-long tour that took us through 12 countries, and we had seven musical acts, five that were officially on the tour for the whole thing, and two extras that joined later on. And that was the Ginger Ninjas, the Genie, Stitchcraft, Amanda Mora Band, and Cello Joe. And then for the last month, we had Fossil Fool from Rock the Bike, and we had the Justin Anchetta Band.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Joey Chang, who is also known as Cello Joe, and his title is way too long to repeat, but let me just say that he is a long-distance musical bike touring cellist, and he does classical hip-hop. So let's take a real quick sort of interlude and play a little bit of your music, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit about the movie that you made that was funded with a Kickstarter campaign. Can we do that?
Sure.
Okay. So, Joey, tell us what we're going to hear.
A track that I recorded at Expressions College of Digital Arts and Media. It's an instrumental track that features cello and beatboxing and loop.
And looping. Okay, very cool. Because that's what I wanted people to hear. What's the name of the track? Do you have a name for the piece?
Okay, yeah. It's called Funky C.
Funky C?
Yeah.
As in S-E-A?
Just the letter C.
Oh, Funky C. Got it. Okay, very cool. Okay, let's listen to a little bit of Funky C by Cello Joe. A short track from Cello Joe called Funky C with his cello and his beatboxing and his looping, and that was very cool. Thank you so much. That's cool.
You're very welcome.
I really like this stuff. I think it's just a lot of fun. So let's talk a little bit more about the movie, because some of the stuff I read was you ran across this director who just sort of fell in love with what you guys were doing and just kind of dropped everything to follow you guys along this long tour that you did. I think it was your tour in Mexico, right?
That's correct. We met him in Todos Santos, and he was finishing up another movie, doing the editing, and he would just was so enamored by our project that he just decided to drop what he was doing, and he started following us around. At first, it was just going to be a couple days, and he was going to do a little mini-documentary, but as we started going around, you know, as he started filming, he thought to himself that this was just too good of a story, and so he started following us around and took over 100 hours of video that's been edited down into 80 minutes.
So you actually funded the movie with a Kickstarter campaign, and I saw that it was fully funded.
Yes, we did.
That's
we
very cool.
Over $20,000 for the post-processing and editing of it.
And is the movie out? I mean, can somebody go see the movie, or is it going to be touring anywhere?
It is being shown at film festivals only at this point.
Okay. And what's the name of it?
That's just the way that documentary films get released.
Yeah.
They have to go through film festivals for a while, and then after a couple years of that, then they can be released for everybody to see.
So what is the name of the movie?
It's called The Ginger Ninjas Ride Mexico.
And so do you like it? Did you enjoy doing the movie?
You know, it was a documentary. We were just living our lives and traveling and having fun and playing shows all over the place in Mexico. And so it wasn't like we were actors.
Well, that's true.
Even though sometimes people were getting really dramatic.
Yeah.
There was a couple scenes in the movie that were, you know, just kind of we did as a joke. I mean, we were just having fun with the fact that we were getting filmed.
Sure. The drama queens.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a great experience, you know, but I didn't feel like I was an actor in a movie. I felt like I was a bicycle, music, traveling kind of traveler going through Mexico, you know?
Right. So do you have any new tours planned? Are you planning to get back on your bike and take off soon? I noticed on your website that you are, like, booked up all the way through the end of the year, practically, playing locally, I guess, or in air, you know, someplace where you have to be in a place.
Yeah, I'm actually getting ready to leave for a 1,200-mile bicycle tour in Australia from November to the end of January.
Nice.
And it's because I applied to a festival called Eclipse 2012. I was accepted, so I'm now booking a tour that's taking me from Brisbane to Melbourne, and I'm playing at Eclipse 2012, and I'm also playing at another one called Rainbow Serpent Festival.
So are you paid to do those so that you can afford to go and have all this fun?
Yeah.
That's cool.
But they're not covering my transportation.
Okay.
So I have a fundraiser going right now, and I'm also fundraising for gear upgrades so that I can have my own pedal-powered sound system.
Okay.
And so if people want to check that out, they can just go to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/cellojoe, or they can also go to, I have a short link set up, and it's bit.ly/cellojoebiketour. CelloJoeBiketour.
We'll put those up on the Facebook page and on the Outspoken Cyclist blog, so people will be able to actually go out and take a look and see if you can get some support for it. That's great. Well, I thank you for playing your music for us, your Funky C, and thanks for telling us about the troubadour that you are. I just think it's an interesting project, and I think, you know, classically trained musicians who look at music differently are always interesting to me. I like that. So I hope you have fun in Australia, down under.
I hope so. I know I will.
I know you will. How could you not? It's going to be summer there.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, Joey, have a great trip down there, and we'll talk again when maybe you get back and see how your fundraising went.
Okey-doke.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Cello Joe out in the San Francisco Bay Area.
What do you think?
Yeah.
I like that. I like it a lot. I'm kind of interested in seeing the movie when it's done, too. That'll be kind of fun if it ever comes around. You know, it's just like Rising from Ashes. They go to all these film festivals, and we don't have them here in Ohio, although we do get the Banff Film Festival at some point. But that's usually mountain biking and extreme cycling.
And we have the Cleveland International Film Festival. Maybe it'll make an appearance there. That's
Maybe we should mention that and ask them to bring them in. I never thought of that.
There you go.
Aren't you smart?
Just have a good memory.
Yeah, well, there is that.
For now.
Yeah.
All right, I can usually remember that it's time to take a break about this time.
That is correct.
And so we will.
Okay.
And we'll come back. We're going to talk about some track cycling and then a little expo going on over to the east of us.
And we might even have some news.
Okay. And we can do some news, too.
Okay.
All right. See you in a minute on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Psst, Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
Ugh, what are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
What are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. It's been a long time since we've had an adventure in the forest.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
You're right. I should get out.
Yeah, the forest is not that far away.
Hey, Mom!
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
I'm Greg Pretty.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
And we are indeed.
And we'll get some hopefully good news after that whole rant about doping and cycling at the beginning of the show.
This first story is really good news. And it turns out that in a couple of weeks, this guy's actually going to be on the show for us. But he was all over the place because he was an NPR story. His name is Ernest Gagnon. And he is from Billerica, Massachusetts. He decided at 570 pounds and beginning to lose the feeling in his legs and having problems with diabetes that he was not going to have a gastric bypass. He was going to be a bike racer. Seriously, this is true. 2 years ago, as he tipped the scales at 570 pounds, he was depressed and embarrassed to leave the house. He said, being as big as I was, I really felt like I didn't belong anywhere. I was stuck in the house for almost 10 years, just going to work and back. He decided to contact Cosmo Catalano, a cyclist from Hartford, Connecticut, on Facebook, and ask him if he wanted to go for a bike ride. Catalano says, by the way, I ride kind of slow. I'm 500 whatever pounds. And Catalano said, okay, I can deal with that. Since his story broke on a 4.5-minute segment on NPR, he's had over 5,500 Facebook fans. He's scheduled to be on an upcoming show to tell us how it's going. He completed his first cyclocross race and is continuing to lose weight, to ride, and to get his life back. I just think it's so cool. So cool, so cool. What about you?
Yeah.
You like that?
That's an amazing story.
It is an amazing story.
When's he going to be on again?
I think it's a couple of weeks. I'll go back and look at the calendar. So this next story, we don't usually look at Detroit for ideas about urban cycling.
No, we do not.
We usually look at, Portland and Minneapolis and New York. Well, from the Detroit Free Press, here's a story about a new urban bikeway. In central Detroit, on the site of a former railroad, there's a place just for bikes and pedestrians. And in many ways, the Dequindre Cut is a cyclist or jogger's dream, a separated below-grade bike path that at no point intersects with car traffic. It's wide enough for a two-way cycle track, plus a path for pedestrians off to the side. So bicyclists and joggers don't compete for space. It goes right through the heart of the city, serving as a passage between two of Detroit's biggest attractions, the riverfront and the Eastern Market. Could be one of the coolest active transportation projects in the country, and the fact that it's happening in the Motor City makes it much more awesome. The only downside is that right now the Dequindre Cut is just less than a mile and a half long, but philanthropic groups are looking ahead to Phase 2, a half-mile extension that will take the path out past Gradiate Road to the Eastern Market. Eventually, the plan is to connect the cut with greenways running through Hamtramck, all the way to inner ring suburb Royal Oak and destinations throughout the city. How cool is that? Detroit is going downtown.
1.35 miles. You got to start somewhere.
Well, and if it's connecting two parts of the city that, you know, you have to get in your car to do, you know, why not?
You've been to Detroit lately?
No. No, it's been a long time. I don't know that I've ever actually been in Detroit.
I have to say, and you know me pretty well, Diane, so you can appreciate the gravity of this statement I'm about to make.
Okay.
One of the few places I've ever been to where I probably would not cycle on the roads.
Uh-huh.
That says a lot.
Yeah, that does.
That says a whole
but
lot.
But you would maybe cycle on a below-grade cycle track.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
I would.
Exactly.
But yeah, not on their streets. And I cycled on some pretty mean streets.
Yeah. This one's pretty funny. It comes from Dallas-Fort Worth, another place where, you know, from what I understand, cycling in Texas is often a problem. As Dallas stamps miles of its streets with new bike lanes, some people, apparently frustrated that city workers aren't moving faster, have been doing the work themselves. Fake bike lanes have started appearing on Dallas streets, and they're so convincing that drivers are being foiled and city council members are confused.
That's the Yehuda Moon method.
Exactly. Cyclist Scott Yokel pedals over the false lanes daily on his commute to work at a local university. It was amusing, he said. I think it proves the point that people are not going to sit around and let the city drag its feet. Bicycle markings in white paint quietly began appearing on downtown streets in recent weeks. Bicycling Magazine has twice labeled Dallas the worst in the country for cyclists. Facing pressure from cycling groups, the city sprayed markers on nearly 4 miles of downtown streets. The correct symbol shows a white bicycle and two arrows. At first glance, passersby could probably not spot the forgery. The false markings are often painted in green or yellow. The spacing is sporadic and the lanes just suddenly end. They said this green and yellow paint and stuff will wash off, but I'm like, who cares?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Whatever.
Huh.
And that's my story.
Somebody just walked into the studio here.
Yes, he did.
Right on time.
Right on time. I like that. So have a sit and pull up a mic and let's talk with Brett Davis, the president of the Cleveland Velodrome. Brett, thanks for joining us again here on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Thank you, Diane.
Well, it's nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Nice to see your wife, Shannon.
It is good to see her.
Yeah. So when we last spoke, the Cleveland Velodrome had just received its final grant to get phase one under control. And the track has been built. It opened on August 30th, and a whole bunch has happened since then. So fill us in a little bit on what's transpired in the past few months.
Well, we got the Cleveland Foundation grant, which was the last $50,000 we needed to put us over the edge. That allowed us to go ahead and order the track. And construction started right around the first pieces, parts started showing up May 15th. So we had a truckload of steel come in May 15th, the second truckload come in the day after. And it was kind of all hands on deck to get it assembled as quickly as we could so as to ensure that no pieces disappeared.
Oh.
So it was kind of
interesting.
A mad scramble there. Luckily, we had a fenced, the site is fenced,
sure,
and secure, but we were still a little nervous about all these little pieces parts with the value, you know, with the scrap, with some of the issues some of the neighborhoods are having in terms of the scrappers. So anyway, we were able to basically 60 days for construction of the steel substructure and then the wood surface. So that took us through middle of July, and then we had about 30 days for the spectator deck. So that took us out to a 90 days in total. And then the spectator deck is 7 feet high, over 100 feet long, and that accommodates spectators on the outside of the track. And then we had another 2 weeks where we were kind of doing punch list items and getting our final approvals from the city for the certificate of occupancy. And during that time, we were able to do a lot of volunteer training. We had over 25 people volunteer for the to come in and volunteer for the programming. So we had to teach them, you know, the opening and closing protocol for the track. And I neglected to mention that all the construction was done by volunteers. We had over 120 unique volunteers. Some folks came out for a couple hours. Some folks came out for many, many, many days. So,
and you had some people come down from Lincoln Electric and do some welding for you too.
Lincoln Electric was kind enough to allow us to give us access for at no charge for one of their engine welders. So we were able to, but we did most of the welding with volunteers. They had a couple folks from their school, their welding school, come down and actually do some welding. But
it's awesome.
Yeah, it was great. It was really a huge grassroots effort, and I was really nervous about not having enough people to build this thing, but I think our efforts paid off, and there was people were just showing up out of the woodwork. So
I'll tell you, the track is beautiful. It's just beautiful. You know, there are videos almost every day that you're running up on Facebook, and you even had one of our local meteorologists, who I know is also a triathlete. Mm-hmm. You put her on the track the other day, Angela.
Angelica Campos.
Angelica Campos
from Channel 8. Yeah, she she came out the other day and was able to go through our track 101 program, and she's is quite a good triathlete. So she had no problem getting up there, and she's not afraid of anything. So
I could see that. I'm not sure if I would not be a lot more timid than she was. So the track got opened August 30th, and the next thing I knew, you guys were actually hosting some championships.
September 15th, we hosted the Ohio State Track Championships. As the only track in Ohio, it wasn't a hard event to get. The bidding process wasn't that involved.
But how did – I mean, all of a sudden, how many people showed up in Cleveland at your track to do this event?
We had for that day, we had 50 racers, we did all timed events because we hadn't had enough time on the track to do any mass start events where there's 10 or 15 people on the track at a given time. So we concentrated on timed events. We did of varying distances. And like I said, we had over 50 riders from as far away as Indianapolis, Dayton. We had a guy come down from Niagara Falls in Canada. So it was a good first meet. Everything went, I won't say flawlessly, but everything went very well. Our timing system worked as it should, and our electronic timing. So it was a great first event. We probably had twice as many spectators as we had riders. So that was a good. It was a good first meet. And then 2 weeks later, a group from Detroit, Michigan, came down. They're people that ride the track in Detroit,
right?
And they chartered a bus and brought like 25 people down. About 20 of which were riders, and we had about 20 riders, so we had about 40 that day, and we actually did some mass start events. So Dale Hughes, who built our track and operates the track in Detroit, was kind enough to run the program for us. It was a two-hour program on a Saturday, and it was our first mass start event. They even did a Madison. The Detroit riders put on a little Madison at the end, so it was pretty exciting.
You know, we are the envy of a lot of people right now. And I have to give you a lot of credit for sticking with this because it was quite the program to get it going. So let's talk about going forward. Now, is the track open? It's not going to be open year-round, is it?
No, the track is outdoors, and it really can't be ridden when it's wet or covered with snow. So,
right.
Our plan for this year is to we're going to be open through between now and the end of the month. We'll have programs going on and track 101 and all those things. After that, we'll be kind of on a, if the weather permits and we can get a volunteer to go out there and open up, you know, we'll be open.
Okay. So they should check, people can check. Are you going to just like post
it
up on the website
real quick?
You
can check the website,
sure.
clevelandvelodrome.org, or, you know, the Facebook site gets updated.
I want to talk about a couple of other things. One is your kids program, which we talked about the first time you were here that you were going to have it. And I assume it's in place now.
Right.
How does the kids program work? And who donated those bikes? How did you get those bikes? Little track bikes.
Right. Well, the programs, the adult and kids programs are basically track 101. So we have a separate track 101 for adults. And then for kids 12 and under, we found that we're better off having a separate kids track 101.
Sure.
The program's a little different, but of the 230 riders we put through track 101, I think we've put 50 kids through. Our programming is all free for kids 18 and under, so it's free, free bike, you know, free bike rental, free track time, and free coaching. We've been doing Sundays as kids days, but kids are welcome any day. But Sundays it's kind of just kids and no other riders.
What kind of bikes are they on?
We ended up getting we've got about 10 kids bikes, and they're small frames, like a 43, you know, standover, and they have 650 wheels. So we've got 7 bikes with the 650 wheels and those small frames, and we've got one bike with 24-inch wheels for the really tiny kids.
Tiny kids.
So we've had kids 7, 8, 9 get up on the track. We've had, you know, it seems like 9 and up is really the sweet spot, where they're physically strong enough to do more than just a couple laps. But we've had kids 7 and 8, you know, been able to ride the track. But, you know, generally it's only for 1 or 2 laps.
Yeah, but kids are just so – they're so fearless. They'll just get up there and do stuff. You know, they love that stuff. So let's talk about phase two, which is going to be coming up. I know the fundraising is open now for phase two. What is phase two in terms of the dollars needed and in terms of what that's going to buy?
Well, in terms of what that's going to buy, the plan is to cover the track so that we can ride it all year round. The other reason to cover the track is that you can have larger scale events without even in the summer, you can have large scale events without the fear of a rainout.
Right.
Or a there's only 2 covered tracks in the United States. So for us to have a covered track would really give us a regional advantage in terms of putting on larger events. So we could either cover the track and just the track with about a 30,000 square foot enclosure, or we could go a little bit bigger and do about a 60,000 foot enclosure. So the 30,000 foot enclosure is going to be about $500,000. And as you might expect, the 60,000 foot enclosure would be double that or closer to $1 million. So depending on how we scope it, it's either going to be minimum $500,000 or, worst case, $1 million.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brett Davis, who's the president of, it's Fast Track Cycling, right? Or ClevelandVelodrome.org.
Yeah, Fast Track Cycling is the name of the nonprofit.
Right.
Now that we're operational, we're kind of our DBA, doing business as Cleveland Velodrome. The website's ClevelandVelodrome.org.
I've seen the photographs or the drawings, I should say. They're probably just site drawings of what you're hoping it's going to look like in its even in phase three. So what is the cover, what going to be made of this phase two? And then we're going to talk a little more about the funding, because I want to know how you're going to go about that.
I mean, the fabric, if you've been downtown in the winter, they cover Krenzler Field on a seasonal basis. That's the soccer field at CSU.
Right.
They cover that just during the winter months, and then they take the cover off during the warm weather months. But that it'll be a similar construction to that. You know, that is a special fabric. It's, I believe that's double layered to give it a little bit of R factor, and then it's supported both by cables, wire cables, and then also by air. So, as far as cost, you know, that type of structure, brand new, can cost anywhere from $15 to $17 per square foot. So, if you take that $15 a square foot times the 30,000 square feet that we were talking about, that's how you come up with that $500,000 number.
So that's just for the cover, though.
That's for the cover, but that includes all the electrical and HVAC and foundation.
Got
so
it.
It's that's hard costs, soft costs, site work, everything that is included in that $15 number.
What's happening with refreshments? I mean, you know, people got to eat. I mean, this is a spectator sport now.
Right. For events, the spectating is free on the spectator deck, the 100-foot spectator deck. We have a hospitality area in the infield for there's a small charge to get in, and then there's food included in that charge. So there's hot dogs and hamburgers and, you know, the typical fare.
Okay. So tell us about phase two funding. What is in place right now to begin to raise this $500,000 to $1 million?
Well, we raised $300,000 for phase one. So that was the site work for the phase one track. It was the track. It was the spectator deck. It was all the other amenities there. So we raised that money through 120 different sources. So we have, you know, about 110 Founders Club members. They each gave us $1,000, and then we've got another 10 to 20 donors that accounted for the other $200,000. So, you know, the best thing we can do is to keep our donors happy and keep them engaged, because they're certainly a source for some phase two funding. The other thing we're going to be doing is, as time goes by, further professionalize and create some efficiencies with our operations. We need to be able to generate some revenue from the phase one track, with the idea that, hey, if we can generate a solid base of revenue from phase one and generate a solid base of programming, when we put that cover on there, we can then extrapolate, okay, if we can do this in the summer months, if we put a cover over it where you would intuitively you think there's more demand. At that point, we should, you know, we should be able to come up with some projections on a covered facility that would hopefully generate revenue
times
sufficient enough to, you know, support the operating costs of a 60,000 foot air supported dome.
Right.
So, you know, that's going to be in the neighborhood of, you know, $150,000 to $250,000 you're going to have to generate revenue to cover your costs on that thing. So, you know, so we've our challenges are to not only raise that $500,000 or $1 million, but to kind of validate our operating model and to, you know, really maximize our programming in phase one so that we can then with a fair amount of confidence say, yeah, we can generate $200,000, you know, with a 12 month a year operation.
Have you thought of any crowdsourcing type stuff like Kickstarter or one of those funds? Out of curiosity, yeah, I mean, a lot of people are doing well with that stuff.
I mean, we had looked at Kickstarter and during the phase one process, but we didn't. We didn't go in that direction. You know, we haven't written it off as a possibility for the future. But, you know, the best thing we can do is get, you know, we'd hoped to start earlier this year, frankly. We're hoping to be ready to go in June to have a full summer.
Sure.
So we did end up with, you know, kind of a short season. So what we need to do is hit the ground running come next May. We hope to have a executive director in place and the funding to hire a person for that 6 month season, and really try to get as much activity out of the track as we can in terms of kids and adult programming. And I think from that point, I think things will take care of themselves in terms of fundraising and operations going forward.
What's been the feedback from people who come and watch this, forgetting the people who come and ride for a moment, but just the spectators and the media? What's been the feedback about it?
Well, I think the most exciting thing to watch are the mass start races. So that'll be our, you know, next spring we'll have a weekday race series. So we're anticipating, really getting a lot of spectators exposed to the mass start racing. But generally, you know, the people we get, if you're there for a session, you get countless people that walk up on the deck and check it out. So we make it a point to introduce ourselves and explain, you know, what we're all about in our programming. So, I mean, it's been pretty rewarding. The people's reactions been overall extremely positive and extremely supportive, and people are always asking what they can do to help. And, you know, we continue to, you know, be able to raise money. People making unsolicited donations, and then we do have one final capital campaign we're trying to close out before the end of the year for phase one.
Well, it's very exciting to me to see this project actually up and running and operational, and watching people go out to the track and ride. And it's like a dream. It's like a dream. We talked about this over 30 years ago. It's really happened. And it's Cleveland. We're ahead of the curve for a change. Well, why don't you one more time, please give the listeners the website, and then they can, if they're interested, get online and take a look, and maybe they'll make a commitment to the track.
Well, the website, again, is clevelandvelodrome.org. And if I may, I'll just put a plug in for this, our Founders Club capital campaign. This is how we got started. This is how we got the momentum going 3 years ago. It's basically we're at 100 paid members. It's $1,000 contribution. We're hoping by the end of the year to get to 120. If we can get to 120, the benefits for a Founders Club member are as follows. It'll be a 4-year season pass. So you get the balance of this year and then the next 3 years. And then you also get we're going to have a 3-foot by 4-foot plaque on the spectator deck with all 120 people's names on it. So we got two more yesterday. That takes us to just over 101, 102. So we need 18 or 19 more. So if you want to make a $1,000 contribution, you can either contact us through the website, and we can give you a personal tour of the track, or just go ahead and make an online payment via our website at clevelandvelodrome.org.
Well, you know, whether or not you can, it's sort of like pledge week on the radio here, whether or not you can make, you know, become one of the founders, it just seems to me, regardless of what you're giving them, they're going to get so much back. You know, if you're interested in bike racing, and can I use the word clean bike racing? We're talking a really good program. I'm very thrilled to be able to say that it's here in Cleveland. So, Brett, thank you so much for joining us on the show and bringing us up to speed on the Cleveland Velodrome. And good luck with the capital campaign and the 2013 racing season. And I hope you get to train lots more youngsters to ride.
Thanks, Diane.
All right. You have a good night.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Well, we thank Brett Davis for coming down for a few minutes to fill us in on the Velodrome.
So cool. So cool. I am just thrilled that it's here in our city. Very cool. Yeah.
And not every city can say they've got a velodrome.
Not too many in this country,
yeah,
that's for sure.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
Well, we've got to hop on the phone here
and talk with Bina Belinky, who is the expo director for the Philly Bike Expo coming up at the end of the month. Bina, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure. We're here to talk about the Philly Bike Expo, and this year I'm going to be there.
Yay.
I know.
I'm looking forward to that.
I am too. We missed it last year, and I did get to see you. Actually, we got to sit next to you on the plane coming back from Interbike this year.
I know. I think that was the highlight of my trip to Vegas.
Yeah, well, Vegas is tough. So let's talk about the expo. When is the Philly Bike Expo this year?
This year, it is October 27th and 28th.
And it is at the Armory on 23rd Street?
Right, yeah, it's in right downtown Center City, Philadelphia, so a super convenient location.
I know we're one of a lot of booths down there. Do you know how many exhibitors you're going to have this year? You said it's going to be a lot.
Yeah, it is going to be a lot. We have about, I guess, 85 booths, but it's going to be more because quite a few people share their booths.
Ah.
So I really won't have a final count, but somewhere between, you know, 85 and 100 companies.
That's great. And what about attendees? Do you know how many people attended the show last year and how many you anticipate this year?
Well, last year we had 2,500 attendees, which was really amazing since we had that crazy, unseasonable October snowstorm. And I was a little nervous, but everybody turned out and most people rode their bikes in the terrible weather. And from the first year, it was like about a 500 attendee jump. So we're thinking about 3,000 this year.
Wow, that's great. Now, you haven't gotten more space, though. You're using the same space?
Yeah, the same space. We're sort of outgrowing it, but yeah. I'm not ready to move just yet.
And you have a seminar series, and I think I noticed that that's actually not all going to be in the Armory.
That's true. We rent out, it's called the First Unitarian Church.
Okay.
And it's another event space where they hold concerts and, you know, workshops and stuff. It's only a block and a half from the Armory. So we use that for some extra space so that we can have, you know, larger seminar lineup. So it's real close by. And so we, you know, kind of split it. Some are in the Armory and some are over there in the First Unitarian Church.
Well, the website lists all the seminars, and it looks like you have a really good lineup of interesting workshops this year. You know, unfortunately, I probably won't be able to attend them since I have to be in my booth, but that's okay.
I know, that's the problem with being an exhibitor.
It is, but that's okay. You know, Brian is coming with me, so we can sort of spell each other. So the subtitle of your event is Artisans, Activists, and Alternatives. What do you mean by that?
Okay, well, most people don't ever ask that, so I'm glad you did. It's sort of a condensed mission statement, kind of the foundation of the expo and what we see as essential components for a vibrant and always progressing cycling culture and infrastructure. So they're kind of the core values that we aim to promote with the event. And then the three things, the artisans refers to the craftsmen and the women behind the custom frames, handmade accessories, and bicycle apparel designers. And then activists refers to all the amazing organizations and individuals who advocate for cycling. Anyone from, you know, a large bicycle coalition in a large city to a single person that goes to a city meeting to rally for more bike lanes, for instance. And alternatives is our strong belief in bicycles as a transportation alternative, of course. And you might know that we also have trains as an alternative to cars.
Yes. How would you characterize the Philly Bike Expo as being different from NABS?
Well, I guess it's a very inclusive event. Any bicycle-related company can participate. And we really aim to make it a celebration of cycling with something for everyone kind of atmosphere.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Well, and there's a beautiful poster. Who did the poster this year?
One of our frame builders, Isis. She does the poster every year. So I think this is her third one. And, yeah, she's a fabulous artist.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful poster, and it's available.
Yep.
I do know that. So why don't you let our listeners know where they can get information, where they can get tickets, and one more time, we should probably give them the dates.
Okay. Well, the dates are October 27th and 28th.
Okay.
So the last weekend in October, Saturday and Sunday. And they can go on the website, www.phillybikeexpo.com, for all sorts of information, details about the show, seminar lineup, and they can also buy tickets there. And anyone who lives in the Philadelphia area can buy tickets at Philadelphia area Eastern Mountain Sports locations. So their University City location, Collegeville, and Warrington.
Wow. You have all that in your head. It's amazing. That's terrific. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you and Stephen and your whole family and all the people in Philadelphia. I'm looking forward to actually looking at my hometown. I haven't been there in many, many, many years to look around. So I'm very excited to be coming to Philly, and I'm excited to come to the expo. I wish you lots of luck, and I'll see you at the end of the month.
All right. Thank you so much. Looking forward to seeing you and Brian as well.
All right. Thanks, Bina.
Okay.
Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bina Belenke joined us from on the roadside, headed toward Philadelphia,
right,
where she's getting ready for the Bike Expo in a few weeks there.
Yeah, we're going to be there. I'm excited. I'm excited to go back to my hometown just to go to the expo. I like the energy of these consumer expos. They're fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, we better pack it up and move on out of here for another week.
I have one comment, and that's to say hello to Rodney Hendrickson. His ride, the Thriller Ride, is going on this weekend, and I want to say congratulations on being cancer-free.
Yes.
Yeah, so talk about thrillers. That's a good one. And I tried to get him on the show, or get the information about the ride on the show last week, and we ran out of time, so I promised I'd say, hey, so Rodney, hey. And that's what I got to say.
All right.
Okay.
We will be back with you next week with another edition of the Outspoken Cyclist. Until then, I hope this weather dries up for a minute or two,
just
so we can get out for a ride. And we'll see you then.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.